welcome to Pond Jumpers, the international podcast for open source developers. This is episode 5, recorded August 6, 2010 at the DevLink conference in Nashville, Tennessee. This is recorded during an open spaces conference talking about Java, Struts, EJB, Spring, and storing DNA data. I've tried to clean it up as best as I can, so I hope you'll enjoy it.
I developed in Java for about 5 years, but I haven't for the past.
So I've been working for 8 years, 9 years as a head software developer for 2 companies, and then this February I started Java programming. Java wasn't far enough, far from me. So. Especially, I am interested in C#, and they are kind of share lots of ideas, you know. But still, jumping into this Java world. So what I mentioned in my proposed topic was also Spring. Or struts. Usually, if we are in the open source world, so I have to develop software now for university, and their requirement was to develop completely open source. So. You know that with Microsoft with Visual Studio Express, you can, it's free, so you can try to go free even in the Microsoft world. There are lots of things are free, but the requirements were Java, MySQL or PostgreSQL database, and all these technologies. So. And I can talk about my experiences, what I gathered, very interesting, for example, about handling blobs. I think many people use blobs, so it's not well documented, I think. I had to crawl through lots of forums on the internet about it. I can talk about other experiences, and I also open if you want to talk about something, share something.
What was the question that you had that made you decide to have this open source section? What was the impetus for you to have this section? Was it to ask
either
those questions, or was it to describe your work and you've done your experience? Or
Ask questions, plus gather experiences, or give my experiences if somebody is interested. That was my
I didn't hear your answer to his question.
He said that he wants to kind of do all the above. He wants to kind of ask questions, talk about experiences. So I want to start by saying, okay, what's your name, by the way?
It's Sabata.
Okay, so tell us, like, what's maybe some questions or something that you've had. Because you mentioned, for the most part, you've been doing C++ development, and then you kind of jumped into, this Java project. So tell us, like, some of the questions or some issues that you maybe encountered. Yeah, we can help you, and we can maybe ask questions about that.
Yeah, for right now, at my work, I face problems with the ops. Usually people store images in blobs, but in my case, for example, I just store DNA data. So it's not enough. I don't want to use a blob only as a storage, but I want to do queries maybe. So if a blob contains some information, or not. And currently I can see how can I phrase this in SQL query. This is a very partial question. Other questions, for example, what's your experience with hosting multiple enterprise applications with one? For example, I work with JBoss now, and I experienced problems when I deployed two enterprise applications, EARs, into the JBoss, and I'm not sure how can I resolved it by it was configuration files were conflicting, so like GNDI properties where I use Spring and the application context XML files. One application simply tried, probably grabbed the other application's configuration files from the class head, and that caused trouble, needless to say. And currently I solve this by renaming the configuration files, so every application has its own. There's a little process to the configuration file now. They are seem to be happy. Also, I will. I'm in the middle of using SSL. I want to these applications will communicate with each other, and through EGB, I have EGB interfaces, and there's so I want to use SSL to. For them to when they communicate, this will secure the communication. I think it's gonna work, but currently I'm facing some exceptions. Probably I just have to play with the trust store and the key store. I already secured the JBoss server itself, so you can access the console. The GMX console and the other console through SSL interface, and you have to log in, so you just kind of simply open it up. Anybody?
Why don't we pick a topic and kind of engage everyone here?
Okay.
So I guess you do have the background. My name is Josh. I've been doing enterprise job development for 6 years. And currently I'm working on a project that has to do with people storing information in IBAP. And one thing I've never really understood is, when I interview candidates, a lot of them have a lot of EJB background. And my background has almost exclusively been with Spring. So I guess I've never understood, how you guys can fill in the blank. Why would we ever use EJBs? My understanding is EJBs were for a lot of reasons used in the past. Maybe because people thought that's what enterprise Java was, because EJBs didn't understand that. You don't to have a transactional service layer, you don't have to have maybe if you're doing something very sophisticated, you have to have like two phase commits and scripted transactions. Nowadays you can accomplish that. So maybe have you guys had any experience doing EJB development and shed some light on why is that so commonly used? It seems such a very heavy framework.
Well, my name's Greg, and I have an awkward background. I actually happen to work for SpringSource.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But most of my career has been, I've actually built thick client apps, so I've been developing Java for like 4, 5, 6 years, and I was building Swing apps, and I was also using Spring with that. I joined Spring back in January, so in a sense, I feel like I've been able to skirt the EJB wave in a sense.
What team do you work on?
I happen to work on the TC Server team. It's my primary job. So it's Tomcat with some extra management jars and stuff added to it. And the other thing I'm chipping in on is the VMware recently acquired RabbitMQ,
right.
And I'm helping out with the Python client software because I also like Python.
You live and work out of Nashville?
Yeah, I work out of Nashville. The my manager's in New Jersey, and my nearest colleague's in Boulder, so we use Skype, Interact, so I work on there. But I just thought it was fun to come to a dominantly .NET conference as a job developer.
I mean, I come from networking, and I've been doing job development, so it's mostly just an opportunity to meet people. But
one of the other tools that I really love, though, the Spring Security, which I came into the knowledge of before I joined Spring Source, is a really fabulous tool to integrate with, pick and choose your Java security solution. It was easy to add that to an existing application or design into it.
My name's Mark. I did develop Java at Enterprise for 4 years. I use Struts, Faces, Spring, Hibernate, never use DJV. We also use TVs with SSL. We use SSL. The key store, trust store. I just never had a need for the JSSE or the EJV. I don't know if we just tended to do our own thing, they could have just easily written an article or something to me, but they made a really big, this way you have to do it. I guess it keeps people, if you don't have a good discipline about, reusing code or doing things the same way every time, the way just only having their nuances be their nuances, not just the way you woke up, which side of the bed you woke up that morning. I can see where EJB would kind of keep you under control. But we did our own little classes. We didn't have to have those.
Well, let me ask a question that probably you know better, that I have a feeling that EJB provides better compatibility. So if I would go with Spring Beans, then I might tie myself into the Spring world.
Yes and no. EJB, first and foremost, depends on an application server with an EJB container. So right away, you can't use Tomcat unless you have a separate EJB container. Most of the time, you don't even really need it, depending on what you're doing. If you look at architecture of EJB, it was really designed so that you can have these local and remote interfaces, so that maybe you can write a Sling client that you can take and communicate with the remote server, and then have a different interface, maybe that's a web, and a different interface that's maybe on a kiosk or something else. And that architecture really never materialized because everything went to the web. So with an EJB approach, you're really kind of tied to any app server that uses an EJB container, first of all. And second of all, having worked on several different app servers, Webster handles EJBs a lot differently than, say, JBoss. With Spring, for the most part, the only coupling that you have is you write all these lightweight OJOs, and then you have a configuration, either XML configuration or annotations, that wire all these dependencies together. It depends on which component of Spring you're using. There's so many different components of Spring, but just at the core, dependency injection and version control library, you're really not coupling yourself to any particular vendor. You're just saying, I want to use Spring to manage these dependencies. So if you pull the Spring jars out of your project, if you could write your project in such a way that there would be nothing that wouldn't compile, it would still compile. But, I don't know. You have to hear that.
I'd say that the idea was, like in EJB, you tend to extend EJB-type interfaces or implement EJB interfaces or EJB classes in Spring. The idea is not to extend the Spring classes. Instead, it's a principle of, well, this class needs to call that one. I'm going to I'm going to write a constructor call where somebody's going to hand me the instance of that that I'm going to talk to. And then, you know, you have some top-level bootstrapping code that reses up everything and does the injection. And that's where you use a little bit of Spring code to wire the stuff together, and that's where they use that context. And like you said, you could pull the Spring jars out and do it yourself. And what it lends itself to is, if I'm not required to have the EJB container wire everything up, then I could have automated testing do the wiring. So the code tends to become more testable because you can inject mocks into your code, or you can inject test stubs, or you can inject the real deal. And you don't have to run it inside a container to do any sort of testing. That was a big draw for me, was the decoupling from the container.
Mm-hmm. I started to use EJB because I had my job, I had my goals, what I have to develop, and I also started to build an application from ground up, but at the same time I searched on the internet and I found more open source solutions for not particularly my problem, but which gives a very close solution to my problem. So I took one of them, and probably I will contribute to that. But that one exposed EJB interfaces for some reason. Probably it will communicate with some applications through the EJB. I don't know if so. I will have probably three applications which will communicate with each other. And I can see that, can I do this with Spring easily? So currently I communicate through the EJB interface. So with Spring, how...
You have three separate applications?
Yeah, three separate applications.
It depends on what kind of communication you might need. I'm not entirely sure if it makes sense, but one approach, a very common approach, would be just to, you know, write web service and web server clients, and that's nothing specific to Spring. That you can use any particular web service framework you might want, but depending on your data structure and what you're doing and how fast the response needs to be, that may not make sense. But if it's just between you and your applications, You can use Hessian or a Burlap, which are two very, very lightweight web service frameworks. And, I mean, my whole objective when I design a solution in Java is to avoid... I would like to, at any one point, take a stack trace, just dump the whole stack. And with EJB, you're going to see so much more layers of stuff. You're going to have so many other... containers and so much more memory being used because it's a very heavy framework. And my whole goal whenever I'm designing a solution is to have that stack don't be as small as possible at any point. But, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of objectives and, you know, make sure you solve the solution, but, you know, I want to do it as lightweight as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. I understand what you're saying. I think also with the web services approach, you again have a little overhead. I can see from my experience what's the difference the extra layers between EJB or web services. From my ground up application, I use web services.
Web service overhead really comes into how you're going to communicate it and what you're communicating. You're going to be sending stuff like blobs. That will be overhead. If you're going to be sending your messages as SOAP, that's going to be overhead. But if you keep it simple,
JSON or
something. Well, JSON's not, and that's like for Ajaxing, you know, your web page with JavaScript. I'm talking about just communication, you know, requests. Like someone puts in some, I don't know. Some, you know, I spent so much money on this trip, and it goes over to the other one. They approve it. You know, simple messaging, where basically you take your plain old Java objects and you represent them as XML, there's very little overhead. But if you start doing the SOAP, which might be a requirement, I've had that requirement once before to shop to somebody to talk to another company's service, it is heavier. And the blobs, you know, you start boxing and unboxing something like a blob that has like base 64 encoding, it gets heavy.
I would say that you need to probably relook at what you're doing if you're storing. So you mentioned that you need to store a column, a blob of data. You need to actually go in and search on that blob data.
Well, really,
you need to look at that.
I really think when you say images, that's a blob. When you say searching on it, I think you mean blob, right? Because how would you search on a blob?
Yeah, you can't index within the column. We're getting a little in depth.
Well, I mean, some databases now, and you can do you can have it save, like tokenize your blobs.
Then you can index on those tokens. So the issue is you wanted to be able to search on it. Okay, it's going to be a full table scan with your blob, and that blob gets genetic data. It's huge, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to be a very bad performance. What you need to do is figure out some. I mean, we're going well beyond Java at this point. Java stack is
well,
more data.
But it could relate to Hibernate, because I have made custom stuff for Hibernate.
Something you described, where's the pen that pen at the one on the right?
Up on the ground.
Okay, I see it. There's a podcast that I listen to. It's my favorite podcast called Java Posse. Anybody listen to the Java Posse?
Yeah.
So I'm just going to write it down here so you can catch it. I think it's 20. And the guy who runs this podcast, he happens to work for a company that does genetic analysis. And he uses Java, but he also uses Scala. And he has done podcast episodes where they've talked about alternatives to something like Oracle or SQL Server, the NoSQL stuff, where what he was doing was not doing a lot of changes to data. He had a huge chunk of DNA data that he had to analyze and do all kinds of searches on, and he talked about using a NoSQL key-value-oriented solution.
I was proposing that to my boss, but the problem is that, yeah, for example, for NoSQL approaches, for example, in MongoDB, you are able to issue regex queries on the fields, but our analysis won't be that simple. So it seems that I have to fetch the blob anyway. So I want it will be pretty memory intensive. And
what you may want to look at is finding some way to design. Now this is going off. This is really just a data design type of discussion. But what you may want to do is consider if you need to be able to search on any arbitrary token within that. Is it genetic data? Is that correct?
Yes.
If you need to search for any pattern in that genetic data, you're going to be unsatisfied, I think, ultimately with the performance of having all of that data in one column, basically.
You can't tokenize genetic data, really. I mean,
it's not simple. It's not a simple pattern.
You'll have stuff like a white space to delimit the tokens, which is what some of the modern databases allow you to do. You can have a huge blob, and it will index on those tokens, but if it's genetic data, there's no punctuation.
Yeah, I haven't seen our genetic data because, you know, it's very sensitive. I just know currently that it will be, for one person, it's around, let's say, 200 kilobytes, bit by bit. And currently, I also don't know exactly how they store it. Somehow they store it in chunks. But what I figured out with blobs, every database server handles blobs differently. PostgreSQL has two different solutions. So you have a regular blob. You have
you have a the really good solution is they have a framework built into PostgreSQL called Toast, which transparently does this chunking thing. So if you store a very big data, it breaks that to, I don't know how big, like 1 kilobyte chunks. And in the PostgreSQL database, there are some metadata tables. If you store those in this metadata table, and your actual blob field will be just an identifier pointing to these metadata structures. And so I plan to use this. I fortunately, on the Hibernate level, I could avoid any PostgreSQL specific things. So I think I found the markups which are not specific. So in theory, it will work also MySQL or the SQL Server. Those have different approaches to blob. Every so
I didn't know if you were planning on, like, you're talking about, you have different apps that are going to be involved with this. I mean, I would assume it's, I'm not sure if you can pass the data around itself, or if you need the data to stay cached somewhere, which you need to pass around as a handle to it. Or,
so in the end, there will be a master application which will run the things, but like imagine more hospitals, and there will be some server which store keys, cryptographic salts keys. So that communication with the key server will be pretty low traffic. It's just some keys, but within the hospitals, it will be the data they will exchange blob data. That's what I so. And as far as I saw, the screen is this this dependency injection framework. I haven't seen that it has any solution for communication. So I have my M beans, right? My beans, my Spring beans.
Okay. Yeah.
But
Spring doesn't do. Spring definitely doesn't do any kind of messaging on its own. What Spring provides is a lot of utility classes that might simplify web services. If you have a particular web service framework or use a particular messaging server, you can have JMS templates or use JDBC. You can have, I mean, these are all just like utility classes that Spring provides that will help take a lot of the boilerplate configuration and coding out of your class or whatever. At its core, all Spring really does is dependency injection, but it's useful to invest the time to look at all the other utilities that it can provide you because it will save you time. So I want to make sure to mention that, but putting that aside, to solve your specific problem, I would encourage you to look at beyond just the Java solution and figure out at a design and architecture level what do you absolutely need to make this function correctly. You're designing this from the ground up, right? So you have a lot of freedom.
So what happened is that I started to build a ground up application, but finally what will happen probably, I picked the open source solution, and I think it leverages many things of Spring. So I have the transaction handling, I have users, I have security built in, so roles, user roles. I got with this open source framework. It's an application. So, and right now I'm catching up with the application itself. Those guys have lots of experience in build that, and they iterated through more generations of this build. So right now there are many parts of that software what I'm not familiar with. But I kind of trust them. They use new technologies. They didn't build, by the way, so they didn't build this application for dealing with blobs. So that's my job's specialty, that we have to integrate DNA data. So, yeah.
Well, if you can't get the particular plugin that you referred to earlier, Postgres, working, I would say you're going to have to go back to the drawing board and figure out maybe, like, maybe you have to build your own offline indexes that, like, say, for example, maybe we know that we're always going to be searching for, like, eight codes or something. I'm not a genetics guy.
The length of the search?
Yeah, if you have some constant, right, you can go in and you can run an offline process to go and grab every eight or, you know, and index that, you know, in a separate, create a separate index for that you kind of build and manage. It's not going to be pretty. It's going to require a lot of database-specific stuff, stored procedures and stuff, but I'm just saying, if you want to make this happen in such a way where it's not big O n squared, which I think is what you're going to find if you're having just a single blob column, you're going to have to go record by record, get that blob, and go character by character from the blob. I mean, that's going to be very bad performance.
Yeah, but it seems like we would have to do that. Because I was asking my boss if those queries will be just pattern search, but probably not. Because I don't know what the researchers, you know, the genetic data researchers want to do, but those are different statistical algorithms.
What do you say with respect to the idea of, like, automated testing or performance testing? Is that a part of your development process?
So it has unit tests. The software I started to use. And for every function API I added, I added also unit tests. I don't have performance tests yet, unfortunately. But it could be crazy. So, the performance will be.
I guess I would think it's something to monitor in your development cycle because, you know, you're a little bit working in the blind because I guess they haven't given you the real data yet that you're going to, real data and the real searches that you have to do maybe, and you don't have a good answer, so you need to be monitoring your performance, you know, and they say, well, here's the kind of data you have to handle, and suddenly the performance just gets clobbered, and then you have to be ready to go back and attack that and show, well, before, you know, the performance took a week to do this batch job, now we restructure the data, we can do it in a few seconds or something like that. And that's the kind of thing you need to know where are you spending all the time so you optimize in the right places.
Yeah, so you do this the web service route, and it's like a web service framework. There are ways where you can capture information about their queries down to time of day, the user, how long it took, to the point that you can actually, I mean, I know that's not digging into your exact cause of this, any kind of performance problems, but it'll show you what they're actually doing. Then to determine because if you start seeing that, you know, average query is taking 40 seconds or something like that,
and that probably
you're going to, and I mean, you can also log or see the length of their search. Or,
my plan is, that's a good question. So, as far as I know, I can run a such a like a debug version, but not a debug version, but a profile version,
right.
Profiler version. It's a little much slower than usual, but I haven't run a profiler version yet. But I will, I guess. It's in a very early development stage right now.
I was building a particular tool for a team that they were ordering telecommunication circuits, and they had a multi-tab form to fill out all these specs. And what the thing did is every time you hit the save button to save the current configuration, it took 5 minutes to store everything in the database. And the problem with this app was you had to go to each tab, and every time you changed tabs, it did an autosave. So these people, to do their job, they basically entered all their information, hit save, and went and got a cup of coffee. And came back, and maybe it was done. And the thing is I went track down the problem, and I just fixed the save button so that it took 5 seconds. And suddenly, they were, like, moving at warp speed. So that's some of the, you know, ideas. It's not all automated and I can profiling, but that's the kind of things. And then maybe other stuff as we ran tools like TopSQL and Oracle that was looking at. And what I found out the reason is my query, this one query in that save button was showing up as the number 2 hog on the Oracle database. So I went and fixed one query and it sped up that entire system and also sped up the database server for other tools that were running off of it. So, I mean, there's something where you can't catch that in Java. Only the users were just used to it and not even telling me that it was a problem. And it was only measured over in the database itself. So these are some of the things you have to keep your ears open to.
Yeah, I know. And actually, because I have Hibernate as an extra layer between my application and the SQL Server, even more layers, I have, it might be hard at some point to really control what's going on with the SQL Query.
You might want to consider, for a first pass, maybe building a prototype that does not use Hibernate, only because sounds like you're going to have very data-intensive applications. Mm-hmm. You may want to have a finer level of control over your queries. I mean, Hibernate, you can do all that. I'm just not sure that you'll be able to leverage the strengths of Hibernate. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a lot of, like, especially with what you're describing, using that module for Postgres, I mean, I doubt Hibernate has any way of leveraging that, for example. You could, I don't know.
Right now, I already ran into issues when the original software, there were some read-only queries, when I just fetched some data, and they weren't in write transactions. But because I introduced block fields, I got exceptions that you have to have write transactions when I fetch out block fields. So I...
The database you're using would not let you fetch, select, and pull back to block unless you had a write transaction. I think I'd be changing the database.
Yeah, it sounds like there was. I remember using Microsoft SQL Server years ago, and there was some weird thing I had to do where I had to do 2 queries to get back blob data. It sounds like what you're kind of describing. I don't think I had to have a write transaction. I think I just had to have. I don't remember exactly. It was something very odd.
Sorry, I don't know the actual exception yet. I didn't write it down because I just added the transactional annotation with Hibernate and then went away. But I have...
You probably have, yeah.
So I don't know if it had to be inside a transaction, but at least I know when you use the Spring at transactional stuff, you can specify it's a read-only query.
Yeah, so probably it wasn't about read-write transaction, but it was that fact that it felt that I'm not in a transaction, and I added the transactional annotation. So,
So if you don't mind me asking, who do you know is probably for
Vanderbilt?
I would say, what's your name again?
Mark.
Mark had a good idea at the beginning of this talk. You may want to evaluate whether or not to put this data in blob, because it's text data to begin with, it's character data. So blob is maybe not ideal, but I mean, it's not going to help you very much.
Yeah, but the thing is that either I use blob or blob, binary or character, I end up with just 200 kilobytes of data.
Yeah, it's not going to fix that problem. But at least what you might be able to do is, it's probably not going to make much difference, but at least you'll be able to see.
Oh, sweet, never mind. I got one.
There's tons of them here. They're black.
Oh, those are tournament. Yeah, tournament power is okay for the paper. Yeah. What was the 2 lightweight web service framework that you mentioned?
Hessian and Burlap, they're both made by...
Say it again?
I was going to write it, but I can't.
Oh, wait. There's pens over here.
Yeah, you got it. They're both made by the company that makes Jetty. And they're both the same framework. One of them is a binary. So Hessian is a binary web service. So it's going to stream binary data, and Burlap is it will actually serialize your Java objects into XML based on some standards, and stream XML. But they're both the same framework, and they're both made by Jetty or whatever company, Caucho, I think.
Yeah, that's a Caucho.
Yeah, and to write web services with that, it's literally one jar and like two lines of code. So it doesn't get any simpler.
There's another tool that I've used, or rather I inherited someone else using, which was the Apache Commons HTTP client library.
On the server side, what does it require?
On the server side,
there's a couple utility class. No, I was starting to talk about something else. Jetty's, they're
different apps. Or,
yeah, they're just...
There are different apps.
The idea is you write a POJO that has like a function call you want to invoke through a web service. And inside the Spring application context file, you create an instance of that particular class. And the idea is you inject it into... What you do is you create an instance using the Spring class Hessian Service Exporter. So it takes your POJO and publishes it as a web service.
Right. You'll need to have an interface as well. Your interface, you need to have a copy on your server and your client. Right. Because
I was writing Google to get the exact name.
Mm-hmm. What's the name? Josh.
HIGHT. Yeah. So what you? Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you need to have the interface right on your client, so that you can. When you call this exploit or whatever, it will return you back. You need to have the interface so that you can actually know what to do exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then Spring takes care of all the rest and injects it. It's very lightweight, but it works very well. The only thing you have to watch out for is this is not as sophisticated. If you're going to expose this API, this web service, to like customers or something, they're not going to know what to do with it. And Hessian is Java only. Burlap, since it does marshal it out to XML, you could theoretically export that to .NET or whatever. But it's not sophisticated. Like it's not a contract-based web service, right? So you can't like say, "Here's my WSDL, and just integrate with that." It's much lighter weight.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a pattern that there's different tools or ideas. I've got a client over here that wants to talk to that server-side process. So with Spring, they'll have some utility like Hessian Service Exporter, which is meant to wrap your server-side service and export it with the Hessian protocol. And over here in your client code, you would use the Hessian Proxy Factory. This is another bean you would put inside your Spring app context. And you give it the same name of the interface. So both of these beans that you create, you're specifying both of them have this interface object. So your client code, you code against this interface, you inject, the app context will inject to you this proxy factory, and it gives you it'll convert your calls into Hessian, send it over the wire, and demarshal it on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And all this stuff, you can go, if you look up the Spring reference documents, the online documentation that Spring has, you can go look for this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You can go look for the hash, and it'll go into more detail. It's 90% of what you hear, you forget about it.
Yeah, it's really dead simple. You'll have no problem getting it to work.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, it's testable.
It's testable, yes.
So I can show to you what I did with the blocks.
in Hibernate, if you're interested.
Sure.
So, like, we do... I have to annotate it within just a lot. So I've read lots of things on the internet, so there are many different annotations, but I just use log. So large object. And I also specified lazy fetching.
So I wanted to go to spring.
It's January.
And like a lot.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really agile.
Is it? I mean, my impression would be that it's just like, you know, you guys are like 100 miles an hour all the time. Just, I mean, because, well, it's a large team, but, you know, Spring's obviously changed direction quite a bit in the past few months. I mean, well, since they got bought by VMware, they've been, like, you know, cranking out, like, TC server and whatever the other DM server.
Yeah, it's been...
And MQ now is going to be a big push, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of different, stuff. It's really cheap. I like working here. My old company is real dinosaur oriented, you know, and also I've shifted from government contracting into commercial software development, so that's probably a bigger shift than
So I used, as a type, I used Java C++, because on the internet and forums they said that you could use also Byte. Byte arrays as a type, but this will probably use the type also specifies what Hibernate will deduct. The actual schema will the type of the
right.
Con will be. With this one, I could use the PostgreSQL, that type of toast chunk type of thing. So if I use this one, then with PostgreSQL, I have an OID type column. And it will automatically kick in the required things. With MySQL, I haven't tried it yet. You can have surprises if you use. It can compile also if you use Byte or if you use character array, but that might, with character array, it automatically tries to create blob. With Byte, it might not do the lazy fetching. So there are very, it depends on the server itself and many things. Yeah, and this also won't go for example, the JB communications.
Nice to meet you. Thanks
for coming.
The Pond Jumpers would like to thank the Skype call recorder team, who's made it easy to record Skype phone calls. Please send us any feedback or contact us about any potential interviews. We love talking about anything open source. Visit our webpage at pondjumpers.com or send us a message through our contact form or simply email us at contact@pondjumpers.com. All writings and recordings produced by Pond Jumpers are published through a Creative Commons license and copyrighted by Greg Turquist and Russ Miles. The content of this podcast and website does not represent any of the companies mentioned nor their opinions. The intro and exit music is the upbeat Roxanne, Sweet Romana, and purchased from opuzz.com, the site for royalty-free production music.
Working from both sides of the pond, the Pond Jumpers are Greg Turnquist and Russ Miles.